Cult Rails and Home Invasions, the podcast. Terrible. The idea of leaving behind a legacy is a compelling one. It provides comfort against the burdensome knowledge that we will one day die, constructing an everlasting life that extends beyond the realm of physical existence. Names and accomplishments become surrogates for cells and organs, continuing to spread their impact in a world that the material body has long departed. Culture is obsessed with the desire to leave some form of perpetual impact, whether it's on a smaller scale, one's children and grandchildren, etc., or on the truly grandiose, millions of people, governments, etc. Unsurprisingly, it became something that I once bought into as well. When my then-girlfriend asked me what I wanted to make of life on our second or third date, I said I wanted to leave behind a legacy. Fortunately, we were much younger then, so that answer didn't sound too obnoxious, and there wasn't a significant cause for alarm. It's difficult to tell if growing older, not to be confused with growing wiser, freed me from this desire for legacy, but I'm under no such delusions anymore. One reason why is that history has largely disproven the legitimacy of legacy. Over the course of human existence, countless civilizations have risen and fallen, revolutions have been ignited and quelled, and influential voices have come and gone. Of all of these famous and then powerful people, how many of them matter to you today? How many of them do you think about on a regular basis, let alone one second? The Qing Dynasty was one of the world's greatest empires without the aid of the internet. How many of its emperors can you name? This reality also applies to the smallest scale as well, the levels of one's family. You may know your grandfather's name, but what about your great-grandfather? Forget about your great-great-grandfathers. Do you even know how any of these people spent their time? What they did for a living? What their values were? Respect is the barometer we use to measure the breadth of one's legacy. And while this sounds good on the surface, there's something fundamentally wrong with this norm. The desire to leave behind a legacy is like uploading a 10-minute video of your kid's piano recital on Facebook. You may think you're doing it for the benefit of others, but in reality, no one cares about it as much as you do. However, there are more pressing reasons behind my dismissal of legacy resides in something else. When someone is heralded for their lasting impact on the world, it tends to come from a place of respect. It stems from the praise one receives for their accomplishments. Respect is the barometer we use to measure the breadth of one's legacy. To illustrate the problem, let's bring in a good friend of ours, LeBron James. James is a 35-year-old father of three from Akron, Ohio, but you probably know him best as a basketball player from the Los Angeles Lakers. In fact, whenever you talk about him doing anything of interest, he's probably wearing a jersey doing something noteworthy with a basketball and a hoop. James is undoubtedly a respected public figure, but what is the primary source of that respect? Does it come from his support for various non-profit organizations, or his views on parenting, or his advocacy of mental fitness? Those things may play a role, but let's face it, if James was an unremarkable player that averaged 2 points a game off the bench, no one would care about any of those other character qualities. The only reason people are interested in James' non-basketball-related endeavors is because of how well he performs with the basketball in his hand. When we overrule a select portion of someone's identity, we undervalue everything else. there's a tendency to make a specific piece of one's character and turn it into the sole criteria of whether or not respect should ultimately be given. One's values is limited to the fulfillment of this singular bucket, and everything else is contingent upon the bucket being satisfied. None of you are LeBron, I think, but this mechanism of respect works in the same way for all of us. We have a wide range of things that make us who we are, but respect highlights one specific area and blooms it dramatically. Consider this identity pie. For Jim, a writer and a father of two. Jim keeps a small circle of family and friends, and so most people that follow his life are readers and peers that enjoy his work as a writer. Many of them respect Jim, but do so without the knowledge of the other elements of his comprise his identity. In the eyes of the readers that follow, Jim slowly, through his work, his one dynamic identity has instead become this. Respect is fragile because of its conditional nature. If Jim's writing no longer resonated with the reader, then they would simply unfollow him, and that would be the end of their relationship. To that reader, it didn't matter how great of a father he was or how much he loved his community. That single slice of work defined what he meant to them, and if that was no longer fulfilled, that respect was taken away. The other thing that makes respect so fragile is the way it clashes with our identity pieces that were previously unknown. If you love Jim's work but found out he had an opinion on other things you've disagreed with, would you still love him? For example, this is what happened when Kanye West's fans learned that he supported President Trump. Many of them vowed to never listen to his music again, while others argued that perhaps his art and his politics could be separated. All the respect he gathered from the people who left him vanished instantly. This is probably why politics and religion tend to be taboo subjects in the workplace. The respect you receive from your employers and peers are dependent upon your performance and likability at work. No one wants to jeopardize that respect by introducing other identity pieces that people may not agree with. Identity is never one thing, yet we often treat it as if it were. This isn't true just for the way we perceive others. It's also true for the way that we view ourselves. We tend to connect our self-worth to a singular dimension of being and treated as a sacred object that defies the entirety of our value. Perhaps it's the role you have at your job, the progress you're making as a creator, or the impact you're building as a community leader. Oftentimes we latch onto the one thing that garners respect from others and base our worthiness on how well we're performing in that realm. Our attachment to respect has built a monolithic view of identity, constructed atop a fragile foundation. Invest all of our time and energy building up this tower, only for it to be knocked down at the slightest headwind and doubt of criticism. To free ourselves from the iron grasp of trying to earn respect, we must first detangle our worth from a singular identity rather than elevating the importance of just one piece. We must widen our perspective to give every part of identity an equal weight in the pie. This expansion of our view and economic path, one's entire identity, is called love. Love is a difficult word to define, especially because pop culture has beat it into our heads that it has something to do with romance. But in reality, romance is just another form of respect. Romance takes the singular slice of excitement and allows it to encompass one's entire identity. Romance is relevant, is reliant upon positive emotions. Love, however, is not. Love is meant to be difficult. It is deep commitment. If love were easy to carry out, it would be so precious. It wouldn't be so precious. When loving someone in the context of identity pie, there are two odorous yet unfulfilling. There are two odorous yet fulfilling processes one must undergo. The undercover, the number one, uncover the hidden slices of the identity pie. There are many LeBron James fans that will tell you that they love the man. They will point to his unparalleled athleticism and his status as a four-time MVP award winner, and that he once led the city of Cleveland to championship. But as you know by now, that's respect, not love. However, James's fans may double down and say they really do love him wholeheartedly. They may feel a personal connection toward him that he represents and the memories associated with his accomplishments. Perhaps they have fond memories of watching the 2016 NBA Finals with their family. Seeing LeBron lift that trophy was important to them as a unit. That may sound like a plausible argument, but there's something deeply flawed about this logic. You cannot wholly love someone if you haven't made the intention to uncover all the things that make them who they are. While LeBron may have contributed to his fans' personal identities in the way that they view the world, they have not done the same for him. They are content with taking his singular slice of identity as a basketball player and using that to define what he means to them. In LeBron's case, much of that has to do with access. I'm sure all of those fans would love to meet the man and get to know him, but he's LeBron fucking James. He has a ton of stuff to do and would probably prefer to spend his free time with people that actually do love him instead of those that merely respect him. The interesting thing, however, is LeBron's identity pie may look remarkably similar to those that we already have a relationship with. Not in regard to the pie's content, but in the ratio of what we respect them for versus what we do not know about them. We do not know much about LeBron's outside of his public life, but we may not know much about our cousin outside of his life as a successful entrepreneur either. With LeBron, that's the result of lack of access. But with our cousin, that's the result of lack of intention. When you think about your closest relationships, they are likely defined by how much of the identity pie has been revealed to one another. For your closest friends, you don't view them as reputable employees of companies that you work for. In fact, that's probably the last thing that comes to mind when you think of them. Instead, you know your closest friends for the ups and downs that you shared about your lives. You know them for the wonderful things you've learned from them about family life, their moral center, and the lens that they view the world with. Those parts of one's identity do not come from a simple hangout or two. They are revealed through a combination of vulnerability, curiosity, and attention. All of that which are used to chip away at the brick walls that shield the rest of one's identity pie. This takes a lot of mutual effort to initially crack through, but the more you reveal about yourself, the easier it is for the other person's walls to come down accordingly. This process of uncovering the hidden slices is the first step to love. It conveys an understanding of, it conveys an understanding to your loved one that they are more important than that single thing people tend to associate them with. It's a commitment to going deeper and reassuring them that it's okay to share the things that are difficult as well. Believe me, not everything in the pie is a pretty sight. Number two, learning to love the uglier parts of the pie. We all know that one person who's excited, happy, positive, and about everything. If you've never seen this person go through a rough patch, then chances are you can only access one slice of his identity pie. Because as the walls come down, the more parts of someone are revealed, the reality of imperfection begins to unfurl. While this single, respect-driven slice can appear polished and beautiful, it is inevitable that the rest of the pie will have slices that are unkept, tarnished, and downright difficult. Once these ugly slices are revealed, how will you respond? Here's what the difference between respect and love becomes clear. Respect is based on the stability of a single positive trait, so if that unfavorable quality is introduced, it will negatively impact the way you regard that person as a whole. Love, on the other hand, is about understanding and fallibility of those closest to you and making a commitment to address those difficulties. When an ugly slice of the pie is revealed, it impulses not to dismiss the person, but to offer your hand in traversing the troubled waters together. The most common example of this would be the relationship you have with your family members. What makes love particularly unique here is that you can't choose your family. free will is laughable. It's a laughable concept when you look at the people around you on the holiday dinner table. It's hard to imagine being friends with your parents, siblings, and cousins if you had the choice. But here they are, fulfilling their roles as the most important people in your life. Learning how to embrace the sibling with completely different interests and life perspectives is challenging. But the challenge is ultimately what makes it so worthwhile. This type of love forces you to stretch your preconceived boundaries of compassion and understanding, which yields lessons that you cannot apply to other people as well. Apart from your family, the other folks that may share your love are your friends. The texture of love here is different from the familiar one, particularly because the element of choice is now at play. Your collective history didn't start at anyone's date of birth, but more so from a specific life stage that you once shared. Friendships are generally easier to let go of than family bonds, but the closest ones are of utmost importance to maintain and to grow. Love is crucial here because deep bonds require vast openness, or the ability to reveal more of each other's identity patterns. The ugly slices tend to revolve around problems with the self rather than one another, with some well-known issues being self-doubt, esteem, and confidence. When these hidden slices are shared, your friendship is given the opportunity to move from the domain of respect to that of love. If both parties feel that they could reveal their identity pies without judgment, a fruitful relationship begins with love as its foundation, when the conditional one based on respect is faded away. But the further we move away from family and friends, the more difficult it is for love to define those relationships. The bonds you have with your co-workers might get close, but if you find out they're difficult to work with or are unreliable performers, you will be quick to dismiss them. Respect is in the driver's seat in the workplace, and the character flaws only serve to diminish your role there. And of course, it comes to your relationship with public figures. Love doesn't stand a chance. Respect is king here, and everything is contingent upon their single piece of identity thriving. I still remember the moment in 2010 where LeBron announced that he would be leaving the Cleveland Cavaliers to play for the Miami Heat. Upon hearing this news, droves of Cavaliers fans what that once loved him took to the streets and literally burned their jerseys in anger. If that's love, I don't want to be part of it. The delicate dance between love and respect. Love is more disposable, or respect is more a disposable commodity than love. But that doesn't mean it's not important. In our day-to-day lives, there are certain parts of our identity that need to take precedence over others, and at any given moment. If I were to map love and respect onto the social circles where a part of it could make a chart, well, I guess I can't show you a chart. Well, anyways, when you're at work, your value is determined by how well to perform there. So it's important to have respect of your peers and bosses. It would be odd to come into the office looking to be loved, knowing that hard work and discipline are overreaching rules there. Similarly, as a writer, I need to create good content and to earn the attention of my readers. Without the proof of work, you wouldn't even be here in the first place. Same goes for the podcasting. I need to find good things to write about so that I can grab the attention of my listeners. Wondering what I have to say on any topic. It's great examples. The same applies at any line of work across any number of disciplines. However, if the desire for respect becomes too large, it is inevitable that love will gradually become an afterthought. If you will fall into the trap of trying your self-worth to that single slice of identity pie and will ignore the importance of tending to all the other pieces as well. This can create the feeling that no one understands you for who you really are, which slowly forms that sinking pit we call loneliness. We often wonder why the rich and the famous commonly deal with crippling depression and substance abuse, but viewing it from the lens of love versus respect will likely reveal the answer. Ultimately, it doesn't matter how much you're respected if you don't feel loved. Believing that you have to hide your entire identity type from everyone must be extraordinarily difficult, and this can break even the most brilliant of minds. oscillating between the demands of respect and love can be tricky, but in the long run, it's clear that one prevails over the other. What are you doing? Respect is a commonly used tool that can propel your status. But love is the rare internal warmth that will keep you grounded. Respect is the conditional approval that is distributed by the masses, but love is the enduring force that is only shared with a few. When we think of leaving behind a legacy, we often measure it by the vastness of the ocean we want to swim in. But in reality, your legacy will live in the depths of the small pond you share with the people that matter most. Let's do it all over again, I guess.
Some things you cannot change.
You cannot heal your way to a world where negativity does not exist. It always will. You cannot heal your way into the most physically perfect version of yourself. That's not who you were born to be, and that's not who you are built to be. You cannot heal your way out of every worry, issue, struggle, grief, sadness, or down day. That is not the point of being alive. You cannot heal your way out of being human, and you are never supposed to. As empowered individuals, we like to believe every feeling or experience that isn't fully positive is just another trigger. If we try, we can talk, self-work, and therapy our way out of ever experiencing them again. We believe we can cure ourselves of negative emotions because to a degree it's true. And we know it's true because we've seen it in practice. But we are not meant to spend our lives discovering broken facets of ourselves that simply need correcting. Sad, disappointing, or nerve-wracking events that are not always blocks or barriers. Sometimes what we perceive as imperfection is part of the human experience. And that's exactly what it's meant to be. We imagine healing as though it's a way to sterilize ourselves into an unfeeling state. In reality, healing is the ability to feel fully and freely, and to know that no single emotional experience defines us forever. Healing is not the idea that we might will our way into physical perfection. Instead, it's stepping into the glory of who we are and how we are, and loving that as deeply as we possibly can. Healing is not the practice of slowly disassociating from every single person who frustrates us until we've isolated ourselves. Instead, it's the practice of communicating through frustration, starting our needs before we hit our breaking point, and accepting the tension that is the natural part of human relationships, one that we can better navigate. Healing is not the hope that we may one day reach a place where nothing bothers us. To get there, we'd have to withdraw so severely we wouldn't even be presented with the opportunity to try and fail, and to be seen vulnerable, to try new things, to be challenged, and to grow. Healing is not about trying to remove everything that is imperfect, but about responding to the imperfections with more understanding and more clarity and more strength. If you are an ambitious person, you have probably spent your life believing that you can amend for the insufficient parts of you. This is a paradox. As you feel yourself from the insufficiencies, you'll chain yourself down. If you're always correcting yourself, always believing that you can evolve into something better, you are never enough. No matter what you do or who you are, please know this. There will always be bad reviews, and there will be naysayers, and there will be those who are dissatisfied with you. There will be mindless comments at best and cruel comments at worst. There will be people who project their brokenness onto the contours of your scars, and you will feel as though someone is trying to cut you open all over again. There will be down days, and sometimes for a good reason, and sometimes not. There will be hours when you need to simply lay down and mourn, and others when you need to take a walk to shake off a mood that doesn't have any discernible source and doesn't need to. There will be people who drive you to the brink of your insanity and then bring you back again. There will be relationships that test you in ways you've never been tested. There will be moments of nerves and moments of pain and moments of massive disappointment when something
you spent your life dreaming of doesn't turn out the way you'd hoped. No one piece has to define you. True for every single one of us. It will be true forever. The negative review will be crowded out by positive ones, and the cruel person will be followed by another one who says, "You changed my life." For every person who tries to project their pain onto your wounds, there will be a dozen others who offer you tools to heal. For every down day, there will be far more peak experiences and blissful highs and cinematic nights, and even the hardest feelings will crust and crash, and even the most dramatic crises will fade over time. You won't remember the hours you spent crying or walking off your emotions. What you'll remember is what you learned. What you'll remember is what you saw. And what you'll remember is gratitude. For everything we cannot control in life, there's so much more that we can. This, of course, includes our response, which is really everything we have. We do not need to correct every single setback, and we do not need to avoid the down days altogether. To clear the muddy water, we must often just leave it alone. To succeed, we must fail. To be beautiful, we must embrace our uniqueness, and to see ourselves as enough. To learn, we must try. To be better, we must be brave in our inner storms. We are not meant to heal our way out of being human. We are meant to allow being human to heal us.
To hotbeds and home invasions. Today I want to talk about friendship. Let me just start with some important caveats. Number one, I do have friends. Some. Not that many. But when I meet people that I like, I really like them. I can almost smell them from across the room. And it's a draw to one another you can slice with a butter knife. Number two, so I understand the point of good friendship. Great repertoire. Great. Three, I just don't go out into the world thinking I need friends, like some hole to fill or Girl Scout cookie quota to meet. And I'd rather hang out alone than hang out with people who I don't love hanging out with. I have serious issues with hanging out alone. What I don't understand is this, the arbitrary, almost flailing necessity to make friends. The anxiety people feel when they move to a new city or start a new company, this tension of or lostness people feel that before they have friends. I'd rather not hang out with anyone than hang out with people I don't really enjoy. And my point is, it seems not everyone in life agrees, or rather, they just enjoy more people, which, duh, but I guess. You can like other people without wanting to be friends with them. I like people. People as individuals, and their most human everyday experiences are actually my favorite subjects in the entire universe to think and write about. And I find other people, on a whole, utterly fascinating. I'm fine talking to people. Sure, there are people out there who skirt friendship on the basis of social anxiety or sociopathic tendencies, but that's not always the stitch, at least entirely. I can talk and interact fine. I don't even mind small talk. Sometimes I'll even gamefully try to amuse myself with it. It just doesn't bring me a lot of joy or value. Making friends isn't that hard. I don't understand what people are talking about when they complain about how hard it is to make friends. Especially as an adult. Or after moving to a new city, I've moved across the country like 3 times as an adult, and I've never had a hardest time making friends. People want to like other people, and the formula is freakishly easy. Smile, invite them out, ask them about their lives, confirm similarities, etc. So when it comes to making friends, That's not my problem. All my issues with friends are as follows. Friendships are often little socially constructed gremlin children. I don't really get this arbitrary compulsion to have friends. I guess most relationships quickly become socially constructed and bastardized. Like, I also don't understand why we all stay tethered to family members, regardless of how healthy those relationships are or how unhealthy. For example, I understand it's a value system thing. I can see what's going on with regard to tradition and stability and social norms. I get the appeal, but other people. As much as I'm willing to say, you do you, boo, I'ma do me, if people want to go through life scoping out other human beings like carnival teddy bears and lining them up for all your own amusement, go for it. But that's just not my bag, baby. Most friendships are codependent, especially the BFF ones. They are so often made up of two enablers who do little more than remind each other in the time of micro-crises. My Tinder date. Ghosted me. That they are not alone and others are screwing up in the same way that they are. Proof the countless cutesy memes and tweets and Tumblr posts and t-shirts or whatever else saying as much. Like, for example, there's that one that says we'll always be friends because he matched my level of crazy. And I like that, I guess. But also, no thank you. People start to feel entitled to your personal life. And not in a loving way. People tend to get a little close to you and suddenly think they're entitled to know everything about you. They position this as though it's caring, but it's not. It's invasive. They're just boorish and impolite. And they're more interested in satisfying their own curiosity. And probably immediately telling somebody else if there's a good story to be had. Then they are generally interested in your experiences or your concerns. It's the controversial equivalent of inviting someone over to your home and rooting through your medicine cabinet and sock drawers. This is rude as hell and not cute at all. When I moved from Edmonton, people who barely knew me texted to blatantly ask what happened. Did you break up with your girlfriend? Did someone die? I laughed. I love how random you are. Like, wow, tack much. You try and tell me that's a care. I don't think it is. Maybe nosy Nora, but definitely not caring. Many people don't share my values. One time I rode a motorcycle cross country. In the middle of winter, I went from making 6 digits, then owning my own business, to being a bartender. And I'm a woman in my late 30s, and I don't really care about marriage or kids. I mean, I would love to have a baby, but it's not at the top of my list. Not anymore, anyway. Imagine how much I have in common with the majority of my demographic, or how much time I spend explaining these decisions to others, and how much of that is more like making them feel better than making them feel better about my decisions. Spoiler alert, a lot. I have so many other things I'd rather do than walk someone through the intimate details of my life and value systems. when all they're doing on the other side is consuming, judging, and refusing to understand, possibly stealing, because that's one thing I am used to with friends. Almost every one of them I've ever had has stolen from me. I don't think there's one that I can name anymore who hasn't taken one thing or another. People get too grabby with your attention. The sheer amount of texting and hanging out and validation is too much. You can't text me every day. I don't text my mom every day. I don't text my girlfriend every day. Well, I guess I text my girlfriend every day, and I'm sure as hell don't want to see a text from you every day, or even once a week for that matter. There's not nearly enough time in the universe if everyone in my life did this. I'm not about to make a special exception just for you, because you feel the need to make yourself important in my life. One of my good friends once wanted a call from me every Saturday night because she'd been dumped by some dude she dated for a few months. Several weeks later, but Saturday nights are the hardest, but like, girl, for you they are. At this point, you're just pulling me down into this with you and making my Saturday night about your inability to get over some douchebag you barely dated. I did this 2 or 3 times before I opted out. People use other people as crutches. Rather than getting their shit together, my God, this constant need for reassurance. It's exhausting. Sometimes I'll invest in people and I'll ask about their lives and really listen and really care. And then all of a sudden I realize we've had the same conversation like 12 times. Like the friend who couldn't figure out whether to go back to the same old douche who dumped her like 4 times. Or just another friend who just hated their job, and another who decided she wanted to try therapy. And once I realized I'm stuck in my own personal groundhog day, I'm like, holy shit, what is this? Nah, it had to stop. Because if you don't care enough about your life to fix it, why the hell are you wasting my time expecting me to care? People get too grabby with your time. A few years ago, a friend called me and left a harried voicemail demanding that I call her back immediately. As soon as you get there, she said. When I did it, it turned out she had done some exciting idea about some event like 3 months in the future. And after she told me all the amazing details of this brilliant plan, she chided me for being impossible to get a hold of. And it had only been a few hours. The first thing I thought in response was, I bet this is part of why you're single. I did not appreciate that. My own mother doesn't get to demand immediate from me unless someone has died or something. My partner, who's my favorite person in the whole world, she doesn't get it either. My boss doesn't get to. The only person who's ever come close to demanding my immediate attention is the primary client, stakeholder in the biggest program I've ever imagined. I was involved in once when I was younger. Only because he was spending millions of dollars a year trying to encourage us in school and better the company. So unless you're going to be spending millions of dollars a year on trying to get my attention, don't make any assumptions or demands regarding where you fall on my list of priorities or for my immediate attention. People can be so petty. I stopped spending time with one of my best friends when she started saying shit like, you're so far ahead of me in life, followed by backwards compliments and offhanded insults. When she started the company, she told me that it's not hard. And when I started working as a pipe fitter, she said that wasn't hard either. It's just a job until you pay higher. And I was like, oh yeah, that's pretty much true, hey? So why not just do it yourself too? Why not come out here and work in the patch and see what it's like? I thought we were equal and I adored her, but that shit became exhausting. People are selfish and they use other people to feel better about themselves. They use them to soothe loneliness or self-doubt, and they use them for reassurance, and they use them to distract themselves from the emptiness of their own lives. And they use them when they are bored, and they use them when they want to do something but can't possibly do it alone. And then they use them to vent, and they use them for options, and so they don't have to make their own. And they use them for opinions, And they use them to feel prettier, and they use them to hear themselves talk, and they choose like-minded people who will echo back, "You're right." And some people actually collect funds so that they'll have enough bridesmaids or groomsmen or guests at their parties. Like, are you kidding me? Your values are kind. Are all kinds of screwed up. People use other people as barometers so that they know they're on track, or at least they're doing well, as if not better than those they're calling the friends. People like to use people. I don't get a lot out of most friendships. I said this before and someone responded, "You shouldn't go into friendship thinking about what you get out of it." And to that person, I just wanted to laugh, because, sweetie, you are lying to yourself. Of course you should think about what you get out of it. Otherwise, why the hell are you even fostering relationships? I mean, why really, though? Why? This isn't about selfishness. It's about basic ROI on our time and energy and attention. I just don't get enough from hanging out with most people. Yes, I have fun, but there's nothing I get out of managing those relationships in the long term. I don't need their life advice. Definitely, I don't care about their fashion advice, and I don't need their book or restaurant or podcast recommendations, and I don't need them to keep me company when I'm lonely or reassure me when I'm in doubt, and I don't need to be entertained, and I don't need the buddy system to go to the washroom, and I most certainly do not need someone to squeal, "Oh my God," to me too, at anything. I just don't get it. Other rebuttals I've heard: it's selfish, it's conceited, it's narcissistic. But is it though? Is it selfish not to want to be used? It's selfish not to use others? Then sure, I guess. Someone once told me, "I wonder how well you'd fare in an event of some cannibalistic event where food isn't readily available, electricity isn't at your fingertips, and shelter won't be easy to find, and having friends you could rely on would be quite nice when that time came, wouldn't it?" And hold up, that's less selfish? Because, I mean, keeping people around just so they could help me out in the event of an emergency kind of sounds less, not less, but more selfish to me. That's sad. I mean, again, is it though? If I'm not sad about it, then who are you to swoop in and project emotions? If my variety of happiness makes you sad, this is a great example of why we cannot be friends. You're just covering up your own loneliness and frustrations. No, I'm not lonely or frustrated at all. Your projection here, not to mention lack of understanding or conceptualization around what I'm saying, is another great example of why we're not friends. But people need friends. We are fragile social animals because our brain still cares a lot of those primitive behaviors. Also, science has mostly shown that interpersonal relationships are heavily responsible for the feeling of happiness. Not even psychopaths escape those statistics. Yes, people are social creatures, and we live longer, healthier lives when we have an interpersonal relationship. I don't disagree. But I'm certainly not immune to this. People don't need friends. People need relationships, rich and genuine ones. We don't need checkboxes or arbitrary bodies. We need connections. On a note on gender, people are always telling women what they should and shouldn't be doing. This includes friendships, so I hear a lot of rebuttals specific to gender. Women should support women. I have no problem supporting women. I listen to their podcasts and I read all women authors and I see films and I watch Girls religiously when it was on. But supporting women does not make me obliged to have them over for tea. Women need women friends. What is this with this arbitrary assessment and expectation of who we all need to be friends with? And how is this assertion not inherently sexist as fuck? I need women friends. Not women friends like this. No, I don't think so. Why we gotta make this about gender? I mean, for real. Friends I do like having are the sort of people I have in my life. I don't go through life grasping at other people's coattails for reassurance or to fill a hole. They're fully functional and rad in their own right, and approach their friends for growth, not crutches as entertainment. Don't dig through my stuff conversationally speaking. They don't pry into shit or ask about more than I've offered, and they definitely don't do it after one or two hangouts. Don't make those thinly veiled, wow, look at you comments. Don't make imbalanced demands on my attention or time. Share values and viewpoints. It's fantastic when we can discuss shit, and I really care about that then. So why don't I have kids? Our significant others. Friendships being one of the three things I want in a partner. My colleagues. I want them to make me laugh, make me think, make me chill. Make me feel better after seeing them than before. Not right as hell, just worth repeating. When it comes to people like this, I'm definitely happy to chill with them.